So today we are talking about pointing.
Last week, we talked about interaction techniques. We started with the three basic actions, which are pointing, pointing, selection. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, pointing, selection, and dragging. The three basic tasks graphical user interaction. And then we looked at a bunch of interaction techniques for the basic task of entering, inputting new data, selection, navigation, etc., etc. So today I'm going to do an entire class on pointing and a little bit of navigation. So there's two goals for this. First, to say that this is an example of the kind of basic research we do in HCI. So for those of you who are interested in doing a research internship and maybe a research career, it's an example of something that is done in research. Now, research in HCI is very wide and diverse. So this is the type of research that is more, I would say, formal, close to psychology, because we're looking at human behavior. The second reason I'm doing this is because I know a bit about it, a bit more than other things, and in fact, I enjoy this type of thing, so that's a good reason. And the third reason is that for something as simple as pointing, something you do every day, thousands of times, every time you move, you tap something on your screen, or you move your cursor with a mouse or touchpad, you point at things. So it's a very, very common action. And you would think it's such a simple action, we should know all about it, right? And we can move on to more complex issues. But the fact of the matter is, no, we're still doing research on this, and every year in the top conferences in the field, there are several, sometimes dozen papers about this basic actions of pointing. So we're going to talk about what pointing is, the sort of key fundamental underpinnings of pointing, which is called Fitts' law. Then we'll see if we can beat Fitts' law when we point on computers rather than pointing in the physical world. And then we'll get towards navigation by talking about multi-scale pointing, which requires navigation, and then more laws of movement to show how we can go beyond pointing, in a sense. So as I said, pointing is the most frequent action you do when you interact with computers. Second more frequent one would be entering text. And I could do an entire class on entering, on text entry methods on computers as well. This is a field that is still being very actively researched. And we know, with like small devices and touch screens, that entering text is still kind of painful. But I'm doing pointing. Why is it a subject of importance? Because when you're pointing, you're communicating information to the computer. And when we talk about pointing, we say that we are, in fact, trying to select a target among a set of targets on the screen. So all the areas on the screen, every single pixel on the screen, but in practice, if you have a button, wherever you point in the button doesn't matter, so the target is the button. But targets can be very small. So if I want to put my text cursor between these two L's here, it's a very small target, it's a few pixels wide. So there are many targets, and some are very small. And so intuitively, the more targets you have, the smaller they are, the harder. Also, screens are becoming larger. In our group, we do research on wall size display, or the width of this wall here. So if I point from one end to the other, I'm going to have to run across the room. Maybe it's not the best solution. Screens are also becoming smaller. From desktop to laptop to tablets, phones, to watches. Obviously, the smaller the screen, you're going to have a problem if you want to put a bunch of targets on it. And if you're pointing with your finger is not very precise. Well, it is and it's not. So what's interesting here is that pointing performance is limited by human capabilities, your ability to move your finger or cursor through some movements of your body on the screen, not limited by the power of the computer. The computer does pretty much nothing while you're pointing. It's waiting for you, essentially, to click, right? So if we want to improve the performance of pointing, it's going to be tricky because we know that human performance, you know, is pretty stable over time. You can get slightly better, but not by orders of magnitude. And the last point, which seems very silly to point out, but is important, is why do we point? Well, we point because, again, we are communicating information to the computer. The computer does not know what it is we want to do. So if the computer knew what we wanted to do, we wouldn't have to point. There would be no point in pointing. All right. So what we're going to look at is first the sort of theoretical underpinnings of this very simple action. And then we're going to look at a bunch of techniques that have been developed to try to take advantage of the fact that we are using a computer to see if the computer can help us point more efficiently. Now, another reason why pointing is so popular in research is because it's one of the few areas of psychology where there is a law that can be expressed by a formula. And we like formulas, right? Because once you have a formula, you can make predictions. And so you don't have to, you know, run experiments to figure out things. You can say, well, we apply the formula, and if I drop this object, there's a formula that tells me how long it takes for it to fall on the ground. This is the law of physics. Now, it turns out that a researcher called Paul Fitz studied pointing in the 1950s. So that was, well, not before computers existed, but before HCI existed, for sure. And his work was not done in the context of interacting with computers at all. And so he studied what's called the speed-precision trade-off in directed movements. That's the way psychologists call things. We say pointing. But that looks more serious. I feel like the bus arrived late. Maybe some people didn't get up early enough to catch the earlier bus. I don't know. I took the bus too, I was here. And so were your friends. Okay, so we're talking about pointing. So the speed precision trade-off. When you're pointing, what you want to do is to go as fast as you can, but you also want to be as precise as you can. Because if you miss the target, that can hurt. Say you're trying to maximize a window, and you miss and you click the close button, and your window is gone. It's gone. It hurts, right? So this is a trade-off, because of course, to be more precise, we need to take more time. But we also want to be as efficient as possible. And it's about directed movements, because it's movements directed toward a target that has precise size and location. So Paul Fitz ran an experiment as a good psychologist. And when you run experiments in psychology, you try to isolate the phenomenon you are studying. So you try to eliminate as many possible sources of noise, bias, and complexity. So he created this apparatus here, which is on a regular table. He put two strips, metal strips. Then he used the stylus here, which was also metallic, connected so that when the stylus touches the target here, made of metal, it would close the circuit and it would allow precise measurement. And they put two of those, and the task was what is now called reciprocal pointing, where you ask to point back and forth as far as you can without making too many errors. So you're allowed to make some errors to force you to take some risk, in a sense, but you also have to do it quickly. And then, in every experiment, we want to vary some factors. So here, you vary the target amplitude. They were farther away or closer together. And they vary the target width. They were larger or smaller. So you have people doing this boring task with different values for target amplitude, which is used to be called A for amplitude, now we call it D for distance between targets, and target's width, which is W. And when you apply the scientific method and you run this type of experiment, you have an hypothesis. And you build the experiment to try to support or disprove your hypothesis. I'll get back in the later class about approach. And so his hypothesis was that the movement time, the time it takes to go from one target to the other, will be proportional to something he called the ID, index of difficulty. And this ID, he hypothesized that it would be proportional to, well, it would be the logarithms of 2D over W. Forget about the number 2 there, it doesn't really matter because it's so long. The key thing here is that we have a D over W, and we have a logarithm. Now, where did the logarithm come from? I mean, why would he make this hypothesis? Exactly. Someone has read the logarithm. Or you about it. So, at the time, in the 50s, the theory of information from Claude Shannon had been published and had a huge impact in all areas of science. How many of you have studied information theory or at least know about Shannon's... Okay, that's sad. It's something I just don't understand. A lot of you have studied computer science, right? Now, computer science, sorry, I'm going to make an aside. Computer science is a terrible name. Have you noticed? I mean, computer science, the science of computers. It's as if astronomers were calling themselves telescope scientists, the science of telescopes. It's silly. By the way, this is not mine. It's some very famous people that have made this analogy before. So, I think the term we have in French, informatique, or informatics, is much much more accurate, because we study information and how we can store, process, and interact with information. And it's stunning that for people who have graduated in computer science, so many, and this is year after year, I do this thing every year, so many have never heard of information theory. They haven't heard of the theory that is the basis, or one of the basis, of the field there. So, anyway, Shannon studied the, created information theory when he was trying to understand what were the physical limits to communicating information over wires or radio waves or some communication channel. And so he came up with a number of theorems, and one of them, which is very famous, is the theorem that describes the maximum capacity of a channel of communication, how much information you can transmit on this channel without losing information. Right? And so the channel capacity is usually, he demonstrated that for certain hypotheses on the noise you have on the channel and other things, this capacity would be proportional to the logarithm of 1 plus signal over noise. Signal over noise, does that sound vaguely kind of a bell? So intuitively, if you have an electrical wire and you have a Morse key in one hand, so you beep, 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 the channel goes over the wire and the wire may have noise. Maybe it's getting a bit close to a magnet or something, and the signal may be affected by that. So at the other end, you may not receive exactly what you sent. And so how noisy the channel is, of course, will impact how much information we'll be able to transmit. And if the channel is noisy, you need to transmit redundant information to have a chance to decode it at the other end. Anyway, I'm not going to go into information theory more than that. Point is that Fitz, along with the fusers, but he was the first one to really do it there for pointing, made an analogy that when you're pointing, you're transmitting information to your motor system to move your hand by a certain distance. That would be the signal. We are in a 1D world here. I'm only pointing left, right. Right. This is the other dimension doesn't count. So the information I want to transmit is I want to cover this particular amplitude, that's why you call it amplitude originally, until the other target. And the width of the target is like the noise that I'm allowed to have without losing the signal, in a sense. So if the target is wide, I can be less precise than if the target is very small. So the idea here is that the D is the signal you're trying to transmit, and the W is the noise that you're allowed to have. And that's how we build this analogy with Shannon's information theory. Okay, so you have a theory, you build an experiment, you collect data. So you collected data, this is data from his 1954 paper. Where he did this task where with two styli, plural for stylus, with different weight, one light one and one heavy one, so the weight had an effect. You can see it's a bit slower with the heavier one. And then he plotted the data, and he plotted the movement time against the index of difficulty. Now, any scientist in the world sees something like this, and it's like, I'm good. I'm happy. I mean, and especially in psychology, where, because of human variability, you rarely get this kind of incredibly well-aligned set of dots here. Now, what's interesting is that first, one thing to note is that at the bottom end, at the top end, it seems to be sort of not really as well aligned as the rest. We'll get back to this in a minute. We see the different points for the different widths, and so they are very sharply grouped together. And he measured what he called the index of performance at 10, about 10.6. bits per second, which is the amount of information that your motor system can interpret it as transmitting when it's doing a pointing task. Now, if you look at the way your pointing movement takes place over time, if I'm moving my hand from this point to this small object here, you probably perceive it as something pretty continuous and linear. I just start and I go there, I stop. Now, this is an illusion of our eyes because if you look at the velocity profile, this the speed of motion of my hand over time, so it's the speed and time, I accelerate, of course. If I'm steady, I have to accelerate to get to any speed. So I accelerate, but then at some point I need to slow down, right? Imagine being in a car going from point A to point B. You need to start, accelerate. At some point, you need to brake before it's too late. So you accelerate, and you brake. Now, at the end, you have adjustment. And especially the smaller the target, the more adjustment movements you're going to have. And what's interesting is that if you see here over time, this movement is about 1.3 seconds, right? 1.4 even maybe. And so at half the movement, 0.7, you've already accelerated, slowed down, and then you're doing the small movements at the end. So it takes half the time to cover most of the distance, and then the other half to do the little adjustment at the end. And that's kind of the key why there is a log in there, but I don't have time to get into it. Now, I said that Shannon's theorem on channel capacity was log of 1 plus signal over noise. Fitz put a log of 2D over W, so it's not exactly the same, even though it was inspired by it. So Mackenzie, quite a few years later, reinterpreted the data with a formula which is more consistent with Shannon's theorem, although that can also be argued. Schmidt say, well, what about A times D over W? Forget about the log. Mayer said, well, what about the square root? And there's more. So all of these work more or less well, depending on various conditions. But there is one invariant, which is that we always have an increasing function of the ratio d over w, and the movement time is a linear function of this id. So even if we don't buy the analogy with Shannon's and information theory, experimentally we can see that this is a very robust law that depends on d over w. And d over w, that's an interesting thing, because what that means is, if I double the distance and I double the target width, what happens with the movement time? It's the same, right? If I divide the distance by 2 and divide the target width by 2 as well, do half the distance, half the size, same time. So Fitz's law can be seen as a law of scale invariance. The time is invariant to the scale of the task, which is going to be something probably interesting when we look at pointing on very large surfaces or pointing at very small surfaces. Now, you saw in this graph that towards the end of the graph, the one with the line, the points were not really as well aligned. So this law is only valid within certain limits that are relatively small. First limit is the amplitude, the maximum distance you can cover. Now, I can stand here and go and pick a target that is, I don't know, in the middle of Jardin du Luxembourg, right? It's a pointing task. It has a distance. It has a width. Now, do you think it's going to follow Fitz's law? No. That's because Fitz's law assumes that you accelerate until the point where you have to brake. But if I'm to go from here to Jardin du Luxembourg, well, I can walk, I can bike, I can take a bus, I can take a train. All these means of transportation, they're going to have what's called a plateau. At some point, they're going to reach the maximum speed and have a steady speed for a while until they slow down. And so as long as I don't have this curve with the peak, but have something that is going to be flat and then goes down, then it's slowly gone. So in all practical cases, if I'm, say, sitting at a desk, the amplitude of my movement is going to be, let's say, about 1 meter. A little bit more, but on that order. Beyond that, I have to stand up and move, and then fits all that in the plan. Now, on the other end, how small can I point at the target with reasonable precision? How small can the target be? I know it's on the screen. You can still read it. So, you know, I'm not going to be able to point reliably at the target of a thousands of millimeters. That doesn't seem reasonable, at least with my bare eyes. So, the precision of our motor movement plus the acuity of our visual system puts a lower limit on the reasonable target size. And so d, the distance, is, you know, up to, say, a meter. W is below a millimeter, make it half a millimeter, maybe a tenth of a millimeter. So the ratio of d and w is going to be bounded by about 2,000, right? A meter to a millimeter would be 1,000. So I'll make it 2,000 to give myself some margin. And so the ID, which is the log of this, you can add one if you want, but at this point doesn't make a difference. The ID is going to be at most 12. Right? So that puts limit on, in a sense, physical limits on the type of pointing movement where Fitts' law applies. It doesn't mean that, you know, we cannot go beyond that, but it's important to know the limits of validity. Now, there's another aspect, is that all these studies of Fitts' law have been done with people sitting in a lab doing the stupid task of pointing back and forth as best as they can. This is not the way you point at your phone or your screen, right? I mean, you do this in the context of a task or other things. You don't even think about the fact that you're pointing. Maybe you're not really interested in going as fast as you can. In some cases, you want to be careful because you know the cost of error, etc. So, how is this model, Fitts' law, relevant to real pointing, what we call pointing in the wild? So what we did with colleagues from the group a number of years ago was to create a little program we installed on computers of volunteers that recorded all their mouse movements and all their pace. And so we collected from 24 users about 1 billion pixels traveled by the mouse, 152 kilometers of mouse movements. Of that, we try to extract what looked like pointing movements, because, you know, when you're on your screen, you don't always move the mouse for pointing. So I won't go into details of how we extracted those movements from this big data set. And then we started looking at. So if you look at one of the participant screen of, you know, its use of the mouse over I don't know how many hours, you get something like this. So, do you know which operating system he's using? Mac? Yes? No?
On the left, I think it's macOS.
This one is Linux. So you see, there's something going on here, definitely. So that's the, I don't know in Linux what's the there and there. Yeah. And then up there. Now, I understand why you say Mac, because that could be the menu bar. But that's more the, that was an old version, so the interfaces have changed since then. But it was where you have the main drawer, what's it called, launching applications and stuff. Now, if we extract these movements and we plot them, we can calculate an index of difficulty because we know the distance and width of the target. And again, the way we extracted that is kind of complicated. I'm not going into details. And so if you plot movement times against this ID, well, we get this, which is not exactly as clean as Paul Fitz's plot that I showed earlier, right? It's, I would say, a bit more noisy. So we did a number of analysis on this. If you just take slices of this diagram, vertical slices, and you make the average, it is interesting that you still get quite good alignment for the average time in each slice here. But this is not really what Fitz's law is about, because Fitz's law is not about your average movement time. In the Fitz's law experiment, we ask you to be as good as you can. So the other thing we looked at, which is not in this diagram, is, you know, what is the sort of the bottom of the cloud here? Now, first of all, there are a bunch of dots here that have a zero time. So obviously, there's some what we call outliers here, things where our filtering method to extract pointing movements was not perfect. There are what we call what do we call them? Happy accidents, where you move very fast and click and you're right on target, which can be explained sometimes by the fact that there are some targets that you learn by using them repeatedly. You know that if you go to a menu, you tend to go down to the item before even the menu shows up. So it's what people call muscle memory. So sometimes you can be very fast for some very well-trained gestures. Sometimes it's just luck. Sometimes it's just that, again, our data extraction was not accurate enough. But if we try to look at the bottom here, we also get this sense that, you know, there is a slope of movement time as a function of index of difficulty, with an index of performance that is much smaller than the 10 bits that Fitz found, but it is still there. So the lesson of all this is Fitz's law is a very robust law. And in fact, people have applied the same approach to other forms of pointing, and we keep getting this relationship between index of difficulty and movement time. Now, this is all nice and good, but in a sense, this is the work of psychologists who study, you know, aimed movement. What's in it for us in HCI? Well, first we have a good measure in the sense of the efficiency of humans for pointing at 10 bits per second in physical pointing. So that gives us kind of baseline to see if we can do better when we point computers. Well, all the studies that have been done with pointing with a mouse, pointing with a joystick, pointing with a trackpad, pointing with directly on the screen and all that, they've always shown that we were getting a lower index of performance than with the physical pointing. So in fact, the computer, if I were pointing with the computer, is a handicap. And that raises the question of, can we use the computer to help us point faster? And when I say faster, I also mean, you know, without doing more errors, because we have this compromise all the time. So that's one aspect where there's been a lot of work to try to make pointing techniques that are more efficient. And then we just saw the limits of Fitz's law in terms of amplitude and size and etc. So can we, through the use of the computer again, expand the limits of validity of Fitz's law, or more generally, do better than Fitz's law, not only in terms of performance, but also in the interval of validity? So now comes the fun part, where we're going to look at techniques that have been invented to try to beat Fitz's law. Okay, so we can look at the formula, Fitz's law, log of 1 plus d over w. If I want to improve that, I can try to reduce the ID artificially. To reduce the ID, I can either decrease distance or increase width. Yes? Because it's D over W that counts. So, okay, so I'll start at the bottom here, because I have a video for the other one. This is one really interesting piece of work by Shumin Jai, a very famous researcher in the field, which he called magic pointing. And he made the observation, he took advantage of the observation that others have done before, that when you point, your eyes get to the target way before your hand. Because you look at the target, and your eyes can move very fast. Although, there's also some limits there. But so what he did is he used an eye tracker and detected when your eye moved to a target and then teleported the cursor there. So you move, you look at the target and your cursor is already there. Kind of somehow it's and it works. It does work. However, it requires an eye tracker and an accurate one, so that's not a technology that is yet quite mature. And the thing is, sometimes you all your eye movements are not for pointing at targets, so it can get in the way where your cursor moves when you don't want it to move. But I think it's a very clever technique, and I'm sure there are applications in some very specialized field where that would be. That's one way to reduce distance, is by having the cursor jump, move for you, in a sense. Another one, another way to reduce distance is Patrick Bodish's drag and pop. And in here, the video will speak for itself, and in fact, Patrick will speak for himself.
Users of pen and touch-operated display systems, such as PDAs, tablet computers, or touch screens of any size. DragonPop provides users with access to screen content that would otherwise be impossible or hard to reach because it is located behind a bezel or far away from the user. DragonPop brings remote screen content to the user, allowing the user to interact with this content locally, thereby eliminating the need to drag screen content across long distances or across bezels. DragonPop is an extension of traditional drag and drop. To drag this expense report icon into the folder labeled junk, the user starts dragging the icon towards the junk folder. DragonPop responds by creating proxies for all target icons of compatible file type that are located in that direction and instantly moves these proxies towards the user's current cursor location. The user cannot complete the drag operation by dropping the icon onto one of the proxies, which requires a comparably small hand movement. As the expense report is dropped into the junk folder, all proxies retract to their bases. The name DragonPop summarizes what happens during this interaction. The user starts by dragging an icon, but then the interaction is completed more like a pop-up menu. DragonPop uses two visualization techniques to help users re-identify their targets within the cluster of proxies. First, DragonPop preserves the spatial relationship between target icons when creating the proxies. The junk proxy, for example, is located left of the My Pictures proxy. The same way, the original junk folder is located left of the original My Pictures folder. This allows users to reacquire targets based on their relative position and thus eliminates the need to reread icon labels. Second, rubber bands help users understand where the proxies on the screen came from, even when proxies appear without animation. In the case of a single wall-sized display, DragonPop saves the effort of dragging an icon all the way across the screen. A much more severe obstacle than screen space itself is the bezel separating the individual display units of multi-screen displays.
Okay, I'm gonna leave it here. You can watch the rest of the video. So, you got it? Okay, what do you think?
Cool.
Can be messy. Yeah, so when it's crowded and you have a bunch of icons coming to you, and that's something they try to address, but yeah, absolutely. If you want to drag them from the edge.
From the edge to the look of the desktop. And the opposite way of.
And so why the fact that it's on the edge would be a problem? Because you're going towards
the.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it can be also an issue. Yes?
Drag an icon into a folder
without
actually dropping it, and then it'll open
then,
it up, and then you can go
into
deeper into the folder and drop it specific in somewhere. So it's pretty.
I think so. Patrick Bodish did that when he was at Microsoft, so it was not on the Mac. But having said that, and I don't think this is actually Windows. I think he did that in a Flash or some kind of a mock-up environment. All it's doing is bringing the icons to you. Then you could imagine that, yes, if you stay over, that icon would open and you could continue. So to me, it seems compatible, but it hasn't been done in big data. Yes? Go ahead. Well, so that's a good point. This is a technique that is drag and pop, so it's really for drag and drop. And if you just want to move your icons, it's probably going to get in the way because your brain it doesn't know that you want to do that. So, and that's not really mentioned in the. and you, the new?
At the same point, that it'll get in the way if you just try to move.
Yes. Oh, so yeah, if you have multi-selection, that's a good point. I don't know what happens if you have multiple selection. Now, one thing that I don't know if it was said in the video here, but it only pulls towards you icons into which you would be allowed to drag the one you're moving. So if you're dragging a file, it's going to bring only folders and the apps that can take that document, and you can see. So it's using both direction, but also type. But you're right that if you have multiple selections that are different corners, you can't do an app. Okay. And so that's what happens is that you design a solution that I think Dragon Pop is very clever. But it solves some issues, and then it creates other ones. And so it's always this question of trade-off, depending on different uses.
Dragon Pop, isn't it?
Okay, we got you. So that was increasing, reducing distance. Now, the other side of the equation is to increase target size, make targets bigger. Now, of course, if you make all the targets bigger on the screen is going to be, very messy and the space not used very efficiently. So, Michael McGuffin had this idea to expand the targets that you're approaching when you're moving your cursor. So, when your cursor is far away, the target is small. If I move the cursor near the target grows and easier to click, right? So he ran an experiment with expanding targets, and he showed that the selection time was indeed predicted by the expanded target size, not by the original target size. And he also said this is very, so one of the variables that he controlled was at what distance from the target does the expansion occur. And he showed that even when the expansion occurs after you've covered 90% of the distance, you get this effect, that it's the expanded size that counts. That sounds super cool. Now, we looked at this paper in our group, and we said, interesting. But our researchers, we always try to find, okay, can we do better, etc. And we noticed that in his experiment, the users knew that they were in a condition where the targets would expand or not. And so if you know the target is going to expand, maybe you anticipate that effect. Now, that's fine. The thing we were curious about is, does this effect still hold if you don't know if the target is going to expand or not? And so we rerun the exact same experiment. Our hypotheses were that people were anticipating the expansion. So we run an experiment where every time they pointed, randomly the system would expand the target or not. So the user had no way to anticipate, right? So what did we find? Well, we find that the effect still held. That even if you don't know whether the target is going to expand, you react fast enough so that even if you have covered 90% of the distance, it is the expanded size that will predict the movement time. And we were surprised. Now, when you do this kind of thing, you run an experiment, you have a hypothesis, it's weird. Because on the one hand, of course, you want the results to support your hypothesis. But on the other hand, it's kind of boring. Because you knew it, right? So it's also very interesting when you don't get the results you expect. Because it's like, okay, what's happening? My theory is somewhat wrong, so I need to revise it and to figure out what's going on. And what we realized is that the reason for this phenomenon lies in the velocity curve I showed before. And talking about 90% distance is misleading, because if you look in terms of time, you've covered this 90% of distance in 50% of the time. So you have the other 50% of the time to adjust to the actual size. And in fact, number of studies show that your initial movement depends only on the distance of the target, not its size. You first throw your arm according to where the target is, roughly, and then you adjust at the end. And only at the end does the size of the target count. So, we learned something. And then we were very happy to see, because I don't remember when it was, but it's about at the time where macOS 10 came out and had this dock with the expanding targets. I assume everybody with a Mac has seen that. I usually give the demo, but now I'm doing this off an iPad, so I don't have the live demo. But get someone who has an iMac to show you that when you approach the targets at the bottom, you can put the what's called the dock at the bottom in the mode where the targets get bigger when you approach them. And we thought, wow, someone has already taken advantage of this. And then we looked at it and, no, they screwed it. They screwed up. Because something very subtle happens here. So imagine you have, so this is a representation of the dock. A bunch of icons next to each other. So imagine they don't expand. So in order to point at that particular target, my cursor has to be between that line and that line, right? The limits of the target. Right. Now, if you put the dock in this expansion mode, and you slowly move your cursor left to right, you'll see that, yes, indeed, the target gets bigger, the cross here, that's the one we want to get to, but when I move my cursor to the right, the target slides to the left. So, in fact, the first pixel where I will select this target from going from left to right, and the last pixel where I will reach that target, would be exactly the same as the original size. So the visual expansion is purely a visual trick. It does not affect the size of the target as seen from the cursor. You get what I'm saying? It's a little bit tricky, and it will really help if you play with it on the computer. And the reason for this behavior, you need help? Okay. The reason for this is because the targets are piled, tiled, next to each other. So if I want to expand this target, I have to push the other one. Right? And so I have to make a compromise. And so this expanding target method only works if the target are sparse, if there is space around them to expand. Otherwise, they have to push the ones next to them, and then you have to have this kind of behavior. They tried something with the targets overlapping each other, but you have the same issue. At some point, you need to switch to the target next to it. And so in the end, you don't have a gain in terms of pointing size of the target as seen from the first. So that's to emphasize the fact that, you know, it's you get a good result, and then it's not necessarily easy to actually implement it in the real environment. Another study we did in the group, actually, was to study what happens when you point at targets that are on the sides of the screen. Because, remember, in the very first class, I told you the difference, the 1 pixel difference between macOS and Windows. Remember that? Yes? And that was the fact that when you throw your target, your cursor at the top of the screen on the Mac, you're still on the menu bar, so you can click and you get the menu. Whereas if you maximize a window in Windows, and you have the menu bar at the top, there is still a 1 pixel border. So when your cursor is at the top of the screen, it's not on the menu bar, it's still on the border of the menu. And so there had been this series of articles or that say, well, you know, pointing on the border of the screen is faster and all that. And so we wanted to study this, which we did, together with Caroline Appert and Olivier Chapuis. And we looked at, you know, what it does it really help to point on the edge? The idea being that it's as if the target was seen infinite. If your cursor didn't bump on the screen but would continue, it would still click the target. So it's as if the target was semi-infinite then instead of just the side. But then there are tricks like, you know, you approach a target with an angle. So what happens with that angle? And we had several models. I'm going to go into the details. But what we found is that indeed pointing on the edge improves pointing performance. So pointing performance is regular pointing is in green here. And the various techniques for pointing on the edge are better. Well, this one is better up to here where it crosses and then it's less good. So crossing and clicking is not good. But the other two are better, although the advantage diminishes that the ID gets higher. So this supports the idea that, yes, indeed, having targets on the side of the screen makes it easier. Point, which is something that hadn't been shown. Now, many of the studies on pointing, or the formal studies of pointing, have ignored what we call mouse acceleration. So you all know the setting that you have on your laptop or desktop computer to set the. So it has different names according to the operating systems, but how responsive your mouse is. Or the trackpad is to your movements. Yes? Yes, thank you. So, do you know what this thing is doing? The setting for the mouse acceleration, or whatever it's called in the operating system. Yes? So what it does is that you can cross the screen with much smaller movements. Yes?
If you move your mouse faster, that point you will go significantly.
Yes.
More fast than and go a longer distance than you actually do.
Right.
Move your
mouse. Yes?
When you move the mouse slower, it means you are aiming for target.
Yes, absolutely. That's the right explanation. It's not just a linear factor. It's not just go twice as fast or three times as fast. In fact, there is a response, what's called a control display gain, that is applied. So our colleagues from Lille, Nicolas Roussel and Jerry Casier, have actually created a device that they plug into the computer that the computer thinks it's a mouse, but allows them to measure exactly how the different settings of the mass acceleration affect this transfer curve. And these are the curves on Windows, and these are the curves on OS X, at least at the time they did the measurement. So what are these curves showing? On the horizontal axis is the mouse speed, not the distance covered, so mouse speed. And on the vertical axis is the gain, by how much you multiply the displacement of the cursor. So if you have a gain of 1, which is all the way down here, it means it behaves like a tablet. It's a one-to-one mapping. And we see that all these curves have this, on Windows, these two sections. One where, as you said, for small movements and small speed, the gain is small. And then as you start moving faster, the gain that is applied is higher. And the bigger the setting on this control panel that you have, the higher the gain. On OS X, it's super weird, because you have the same thing of this first part of the curve, and then the second part, and then you have a third part where things go slower, where the gain diminishes if you go even faster. Nobody knows why. The thing even weirder is this point here. And I suspect there is somewhere in the code a table that encodes those functions, and someone misentered a number or something. There's absolutely no reason for this. Now, there have been studies of how does mass acceleration affect performance of pointing, because you know it makes you feel like you're faster. Now, if you put the settings too high, it's going to look like you're losing control. But everybody has their own sweet spot where they feel like you know they're getting you know a good response from the mouse. And strangely enough, the early studies by Stuckart on the effect of this mass acceleration showed that it did not affect performance. People think they were pointing faster, but in effect, it didn't. Jerry Casier made very thorough analysis of all this and ran new experiments, and in fact, he showed that there is an effect. And probably at the time where Stuckart was doing it, the technology for mice was still mostly mechanical mouse, and so not very good. Now we have very precise mouse with very fast and all that, and that probably affects the way people adapt to this control display ratio. Now, this control display ratio, this acceleration, is completely ignorant of anything that's on the screen. Right? It's only looking at how fast you're moving the mouse, how fast I'm moving the cursor. Whether the screen is blank or has stuff on it, doesn't matter. Well, what if we adapt the gain to what's on the screen? So this is work that we did with my former student, Renaud Blanc, who's now researcher in Grenoble, Yves Guillard, which you knew before. And we created what we call semantic pointing. Now, I remember the example of the duck. In the duck, the target got bigger visually, but from the perspective of the mouse, it had the same size. Well, with semantic pointing, we're doing the exact opposite. We make it so the visual size of the target does not change. The screen stays the way it is. But by manipulating the gain of the mouse in real time, we make it look, from the perspective of the mouse, as if the targets are bigger than they are on the screen. That looks like impossible, right? So, stay with me for a second. Imagine you have a dialog box like this. This text, well, it's useful because you want to read what the message is, but from the perspective of pointing, it's completely useless. Then you have three buttons here, which are really the interesting things, because that's what you want to point at. There is a safe one, save. there is the dangerous one, don't save, and there is the cancel. Now, this is what you see, but this is what your mouse is seeing. As you move the mouse, it's as if the save button is super big, the cancel one is the same size, and the dangerous one is super small. You can apply that to a scroll bar. A scroll bar is a lot, I mean, these days we don't see scroll bars as much as we used to, but a scroll bar is a lot of space. It has to be big enough so you can reliably click at the arrows and the thumb and all that, but it's taking a lot of dead pixels. So you could make the scroll bar a lot smaller, small enough so you can see the thumb here, but not more. But in the motor space, from the perspective of the mouse, make it so these three points are much bigger. Now, how do we do this? Well, the key idea is, as your cursor is moving, we can measure the distance between the cursor and the nearby target. And essentially, if we are in an area where there is no target, it's not interesting for the cursor. So we increase the gain so you travel faster in emptiness. And we, when you get close or on top of targets, we can lower the gain so that it gets easier to reach those targets. I have a small video here, and online I'll put a Java applet that you can play with, because that's very hard to understand if you're not yourself moving the cursor. So here on the left, you have the screen, what you see, with windows, with the resize button here, with icons. On the right is the world as seen from the mouse cursor. Forget about the bottom. So here, I'm moving my cursor, and I'm in normal mode, no semantic pointing. I have to point at these different targets, and you see this. The thing is the same. Now I enable semantic pointing, and now you see that when I approach the little resize button, it got bigger from the mouse cursor. And that's to visualize the change of in the gain. The gain is actually shown here. So when I go to an icon, the enhancement is not as big, and I show that on the resize button. Now, when you move your cursor, it looks like, you know, it's kind of slowing down. It takes a bit more effort when you approach small targets. So we run an experiment. This is what we do to see, you know, if it really worked. What we found is that yes, the time to point at targets is predicted by the expanded size in motor space, not by the visual size. So our trick worked. And you are more efficient. The thing that was interesting is the users were not aware of what was going on, which is, I think, super good, because, you know, we make them point faster, they don't even realize. So this is a paper, because I think it's a very interesting result where you can make pointing more efficient without changing anything visually, which is different from any of the other techniques that we have seen or I'm going to show. Now, with the same co-authors, we went a step beyond and said, well, why not even completely skip empty space? What if the cursor, when it leaves a target, directly jumps to another target in that direction? That's what called object pointing. Now we did a back and forth pointing task, and we showed that we could point in constant time, which is amazing. I mean, we literally beaten Kitsov, because no matter the distance or the width, you leave a target, you get to the other one, you click, you go back, and that target. The target would be 20 kilometers away. It would work the same. Now, of course, in a real setting, you have a bunch of targets, and so when you leave a target and you jump to a new one, if it's the one you want, it's very good. If it's not, it's very frustrating because then you have to convince it to go to the right target. So it's not a practical technique for a real setting, but it was an interesting exercise in pushing that idea to the max. And in fact, it probably contributed to the invention of what is another very famous pointing technique called the bubble cursor, by Tony Grossman from Toronto. Because it starts with the same idea. It says, well, when you want to point at something, the empty space is really wasted. So instead of doing the jump the way we did, having the cursor jump, what it did was to say, well, let's divide the space in areas according to the Voronoi diagram. Have you heard of this thing? Yes. So the Voronoi diagram is you have a set of points, and you create an area around each point so that every point in that area is closer to this point than to any of the other points in the initial distribution. You can build this from something called the Delaunay triangulation. Okay? No. I know you guys. They're the math guys. They know this stuff. So Delaunay is you create a set of triangles from these dots here by linking each dot to the closest one. And in fact, the Voronoi is the what's called the median of each of these segments. Anyway, you can build this thing with a very efficient algorithm that tells you for any position of the cursor which is the closest target. And so what they did is a cursor the bubble cursor.
And hint selection in both dense and sparse target environments. The bubble cursor continuously grows and shrinks such that there is always exactly one target within its boundaries. There are two main problems in standard area cursors which we address in the design of the bubble cursor. Area cursors are generally square or rectangular, which means a target that is further away from the cursor location can be selected before a target which is closer. We use a circular area cursor, so that the closest target will always be selected first. The second problem is the size of the cursor. If too large, multiple targets will be in its bounds. If too small, the area cursor may not capture any targets. Our solution is to continuously update the size of the cursor, so that there is always exactly one target within its bounds. To calculate the radius of the cursor, consider the two closest targets. We define con di as the length required to completely contain the closest target.
I'm going to stop here because. So you get the idea that instead of having just a cross of the cursor, you have an area. And area cursors have been studied, and I didn't mention them. But the idea here is that the area, the cursor is circular, and the area changes so that you always include the closest target. So as you move your cursor, this bubble, that's why it's called the bubble cursor, grows and shrinks. But at every point in time, if you click, even in your cursor being in the void, it will select exactly one target. And so they showed through an experiment that this was better than any of the other pointing techniques. And indeed, because what it does, if you remember the diagram here, is as if each target was as big as it could without overlapping the nearby targets. So anywhere you click, you select a target. That's the idea. Now, of course, that doesn't work if you want to select target, but also select a point. So imagine you're in your file system interface, and you want to either select a file or maybe do a rectangular selection. So in current interfaces, to select an icon, you click on the icon, and if you click outside an icon, you start the rectangular selection, right? Now here, everywhere you click, you're going to select the nearby icon. So either you have to create a new mode, but that becomes... So we took this... so again, in our group, this is again Olivier Chapuis with the two other colleagues here, Jean-Baptiste Labrune and Emmanuel Pietrigard. They created a variant of the bubble cursor where it becomes a bubble only when you move the cursor fast enough. And if you pause, it becomes a regular cursor, so you can do a regular click. So you get the advantage of the bubble cursor, we can see here, where it stays the bubble when you move it. But if you pause, you can click and select one point on the screen. Okay, and they ran the experiment, it works, it's cool. I have to move along because I'm getting behind as usual. So, are we done? I mean, we've seen between semantic pointing and bubble cursor or the diner spot, what looks like it's the limit of what we can do. You know, we cannot use more space on the screen. Well, people have tried to do even better techniques by using prediction of various sorts. What's important is that there are two categories of techniques. One are the target agnostic one, the techniques that work without having to know what the targets are in advance. And then the target aware ones that needs to know the potential targets. Now, not surprisingly, if the system knows what the potential targets are, it's going to be better able to help you than if it doesn't. So the best techniques today, semantic pointing, bubble cursor, are target aware. They need to know what the targets are. But it's often difficult to know because the target, the cursor is moving, you know, on the screen and usually does not, I mean, in terms of the operating system that's managing the cursor and all that, having to query the application to know which target are there and all that is usually quite complicated, so it's hard to implement. So some people have tried to use probabilistic approaches, saying, well, where are people pointing, and trying to essentially estimate the target after you've pointed, so that if you're pointing close, but close enough to a target, it will still count, so it's as if the target were bigger, and things like this. This is just to show that there is a lot of innovation still in that area. But then I want to go to another aspect of this, which is to go beyond the limits of validity of Fitts' law, which again is an idea of about 12 bits, so a ratio of about 2,000 between the distance, maximum distance, and smallest width. Now, one way to go beyond these limits is to use what we call a multi-scale interface and to use zoomable environments. Now, you're all familiar now with Google Maps and all these map applications and where you zoom in and out, right? This is, in fact, fairly recent. Not very long ago, these zoomable applications didn't exist. The data for the maps didn't exist. The computers were not powerful enough to do continuous zooming in and zooming out. But people have had this idea of using zoomable interface from very long. In fact, if you remember the video I showed of Evan Sutherland Sketchpad, 1963, he had a continuous zoom function in there already. And in around 1992, there was work at NYU by Ken Perlin, and then by Ed Fox, Ben Peterson, and Jim Holland at the University of New Mexico created zoomable interfaces. The idea that you would have information that is in a space that you could see at different levels of scale. So one of the examples they had was this calendar where you first see the word calendar. As you zoom in, the word calendar becomes bigger and starts fading out and reveals the years, 1991, etc., as you zoom into the year here starts to fade out, and you see the month, and then you get into the days, and etc. And of course, you can zoom out. So this is called semantic zooming, because the level of detail that you see depends on the scale, which is also what you see on maps. You don't see all the details of the map when you see an entire continent at once. And then when you zoom in, where it says Paris, that's going to disappear because you see now the city of Paris in the streets and etc. So you have this notion of level of detail that depends on the scale at which you're doing the content. So here is a video of music, sorry.
Our research groups at the University of New Mexico and New York University have been looking at alternatives to the Windows icons, menus, and pointer, or WIMP interface metaphor that has become so prevalent. We have been exploring a novel user interface paradigm based on zooming. The interface metaphor we present is that of a huge planar information surface where documents can be placed not only in any position, but also scale to any size. Zooming user interfaces, or ZUIs, are exciting to us because they present a possible solution to problems that plague traditional Windows-based user interfaces.
Okay, you'll watch the rest of the video. So it was this idea that you have this zoomable world where you could put information at any level of detail and manage a much richer environment. Have any of you seen the Prezi thing to do slide presentations?
Yes.
It came out of this. But they did that in the early 1990s, and again, it took 20 years for it to come out of it. Now, pointing in a multi-scale world. That's sort of the new take on pointing, because imagine you are looking at the map of the world in Google Maps. You are looking at the place, where you used to live before coming here, and then you want to know where this Paris-La Clé thing, and so you need to navigate and find France, and then Paris, and then Saclay if you know where it is, and etc. So it's useful to represent a zoomable world as a world in three dimensions, where you have the usual X and Y here. So if I cut this at any level, I have a view. But the vertical axis is the scale. So if I'm higher up, the world is bigger. If I'm further down, the world is smaller. If I'm at zero, the world is collapsed. It's the Big Bang. It's the black hole. We don't go there. Right? Now, the view at which you, through which you're looking at this world is a window. And that window does not change size as you go up and down. The window stays the same size. The world gets bigger or smaller. So if I'm in this world, I'm in the bar of the Z letter here, and I want to go all the way to the M, well, I could do a scrolling movement called panning and go horizontally and pan for hours and hours. Imagine you have Paris and you want to scan to go to Beijing. It's going to take a while. So what you do spontaneously, you zoom out, right? You zoom out, so you see more. You see the letter Z here, then you see maybe the Z and the O. When you're far back enough, you pan a little bit, you get the M, and then you start zooming in. Now, the zooming in is usually a lot slower, because if you zoom in too fast, you're going to let the target go by, and then you'll have to zoom out again. So zooming out is fast. Zooming in is more like directional. Now, if you think of this, this is incredibly different from the tapping task from Paul Fitz, going back and forth. Well, we ran an experiment with the stupid pointing experiment, as simple as you could make it, to point in a world where you could also zoom in and out. So the system would show you that there is a target in the direction. It didn't tell you how far or how big it was, and you had to zoom out. Then you see the target as a little red dot. As long as it's a red dot, it means it's too small for you to actually click it, but it's there. And if you zoom enough so the target is big enough, it turns red, and there you can click it. So you would do this kind of maneuver of zooming out and figuring out what the target is, and zoom in as fast as you could without losing it until it turns green and you could click it. And we measured the time it took people to do this pointing task. So we did it at scales where you did not need to zoom in and out. Here we are around 10, 10, 12 is about the limit, I said. So people started actually to use zooming around 8. We went all the way to 30. Now, an ID, an index of difficulty of 30 bits means there is a ratio of 1 billion between the distance and the size. It's as if you're standing here and you have to go pick a particular flower in a particular garden in New Zealand. Right? Now, amazingly enough, if we plot the movement time as a function of the ID, we get this amazing regression where people were pointing in time exactly predicted by Pitson. I find it magic. Because the movement is so different from the traditional pointing movement. So we can be very efficient. The other thing is that in mathematical terms, when you the most efficient trajectory in this 3D space, space plus scale, is not the straight line. In fact, it's a very complex line mathematically. Yet, spontaneously, people use that optimal trajectory of zooming out and then zooming in to get to the target. So we are comfortable even in non-Euclidean spaces. Who knew? We also tested, I'm running pretty late, we also tested the effect of the view size, because when you have a zoomable world, you see it through a window. So obviously, the smaller the window, the harder it is, because you may lose the target a lot more easily when you're zooming in. And we were very surprised, because the first experiment we ran, we didn't see an effect size except for very small windows, like the size of a watch. So we had to rerun the experiment with much smaller range of window sizes to actually see an effect. And in this part of the graph here, we show that movement time was proportional to ID divided by view size. So we're able to sort of operationalize the effect of view size on pointing performance and have a formula that helps you predict, you know, if you're on a very small view, the performance hit that you will get. But interestingly, this effect levels pretty early on and then gets out of the picture. Now, this has led to a number of techniques to, because then we ask the same question, can we make pointing more efficient in a zoomable world? So there was a system created by colleagues, show their names here. I think it's Andy Cover from New Zealand, as a matter of fact. Did a technique called SDAS, speed-dependent automatic zooming. The idea was that you go over a very long document, and that's, you know, can be painful, because if the ratio between the size of the scroll bar and the size of the document is very, very high, the tiny movement on the scroll bar is going to make you jump. So you need something to measure. So what they did was to have something that, in a sense, was closer to movement with navigating with a joystick, where the gain between the movement in the scroll bar and the movement of the document depended on your speed of motion. And that was seen as the best technique at the time, as DAS. And, well, Caroline Lapierre, again, that we saw earlier, and Jean-Ni Lafayette, another one of my former students, created a system called OrthoZoom, which allows you not to vary the scale automatically like SDAS is doing, but you are in control of the scale. So if you're moving vertically, you're scrolling, but if you're moving horizontally, you are changing the scale of the document. And so you can combine the two to combine controlling the scale and controlling position. I think the video will help. audio on this? Okay, there's none. So we have 150,000 lines of text, all the plays of Shakespeare. And so we want to navigate in this text. So here we are moving to the left, and you see that the text zooms out. Then what you see is not the text, but the structure of it, the acts, the scenes, the plays. And then when I move the other direction, I get back the detail, and I can get to the point I wanted. So this works only because you have semantic zooming, so that if I zoom out, I can see a higher level structure than just the text itself, which you see becomes unreadable. Now, having this structure also means that if I stop my motion when I'm zoomed out, I can directly go to that anchor in the text, like the beginning of the play or the beginning of the act. So it gives me a way of doing structured navigation. And so they ran an experiment, again, this is what we do, to compare it with SDAS, which was the best known technique at the time, and they showed that orthozoom was twice as fast as SDAS. And, you know, in HCI, when you get a 10% gain over the best known technique, you're really happy. When you get a factor of 2, you're very, very happy. So that was a very good result. Okay, just to wrap this up, there's been a lot of work on refining Pitt's law, for example, pointing at 2D targets because they have a width and a height, so when it's a rectangle, what is the size of the target? It's not a single number, there's a bunch of complicated formulas. They all have D over W somehow, so you know that's the big invariant. Chimin Jai, together with Johnny Acott, look at the crossing task, which is on pen-based interfaces, instead of having to tap an icon or a button, they found it was more efficient to cross, to have a little line, and with the pen to tap, go over, and lift the pen. And they showed that the crossing task followed exactly the same formula of Pitt's law, except that here the width of the target is actually the height of the goal that you have to traverse. That led to the steering law that I don't have time to go into. Maybe the TAs will know more about it. But this crossing interaction was put to work in an actual pane-based interface called Crossy. And I'll just show you the beginning of the video here before they come in.
Struggle. Rather than use the stroke, which is the natural mode of interaction with the pen, the point and click interface restricts the interaction to a series of discrete steps, like here, where we change the attributes of the pen tip.
So here you have to tap, 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 and with the pen you often slide and make mistakes.
Based solely on crossing. In our application, named Crossy, basic interaction steps are strokes made through crossing widgets.
So here, selecting both the color and thickness in one stroke.
And width of the pen in one stroke. In the next scenes, we display the normally invisible pen strokes on the widgets. Our system uses a tool palette with 5 buttons.
So in the tool palette, you have to cross.
Each tool, like the highlighter and the eraser, can be selected by crossing them from right to left. Other kinds of buttons are provided as well. To access them, we open the pen dialog box by extending the stroke outside the pen.
So here you get a dialog box.
Here we see several radio buttons. We cross them from right to left to select the characteristic of a pen. As shown here, the layout of our windows makes it easy to select several attributes in one stroke.
Okay, I'll let you watch the end of the video. There's something very cool about the search and replace feature in that interface. I'll let you look at it. So, to close, well, first, there's still things we can do with something as basic as pointing. Second, Pitt's law is very robust, even though it has limits and all that. It's shown as a very useful tool to help us predict and improve interaction techniques. And Pitt's law was inspired by information theory, and indeed, information is key. The information that you have on the display to guide the movement, or that can help the system, also understand what you're doing, the information you're able to perceive, the information produced by your motor system as you input stuff in the computer through your movements, and the information that the system is able to extract from the movements to improve pointing performance. So that's it for me. I think now you're fed up with pointing, so next time, tomorrow, we'll go into something rather different. But I wanted to show you know, the type of more fundamental research we can do at HCI that can still have a big impact on the usability of systems. Any pressing question? Okay, well, I guess you're entitled to a small break, yes?
Minute break for everyone. We have a lot to do today, so please come back like in 10 minutes. So at 11:15.